Hey, this is Catherine Hardwick. I'm the director of Miss You Already, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Adam Sharkoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 414 of the podcast. I hope everybody enjoyed that last episode with Bob Hawke. It seems like people really responded to it. There was a lot of comments and social media sharing about it. I think Bob Hawke is a real hero. So based on that, I think we're going to have to bring him back real soon. Thank you to Bob for being so open about his life and his career. He's a special, special guy. Anyhow, this is episode, as I mentioned already, number 414 of the podcast. And on this episode, we have three segments, and so it's a real busy show. We have two documentaries and a foreign language narrative film on this podcast episode. First up here is a special filmmaker based here in Brooklyn. She's lived in Asia for good portions of her life, as well as here in New York. She went to NYU as a film student and has made a number of shorts over the years, and she has just finally released her first feature film, and it's really special. It's called Popeye. Now, it's spelled with two words, P-O-P, and then A-Y-E. In New York, it's currently playing at the very prestigious theater called Film Forum, and for those regular listeners of mine, whether you're living in New York or not, you are probably at this point familiar with the theater, because we in the last weeks have had on both Bruce Goldstein, who programs the Repertory Theater there, and Karen Cooper was just on a couple weeks ago. And she, of course, programs contemporary cinema, new theatrical releases. So one of those is Popeye. And it's directed again by Kirsten Tan, who is living in and based in Brooklyn. And this new movie is about a man who is, let's say, sort of transitioning from middle age into older years. He's an architect living in, I think it's Bangkok, and he is at a point in experiencing an existential crisis in his life and comes across the elephant that he grew up taking care of on his uncle's farm. And he decides he's going to return the elephant to his uncle's farm. And of course, because getting a lift is not so easy, they kind of have to walk most of the way. So this is a road movie, but a very, very different kind of road movie. And it is was shot entirely in Thailand. So, but it is a comedy. It's a dramedy. It's a wonderful film. If you are in the New York area, do get down to Film Forum, because it is currently there. It premiered this past Wednesday. If you're listening to the show, that would have been on Wednesday, the 28th of June. So, if you can, try to make it down there. I'm sure it'll be available on other platforms soon enough, but for now, that's where it is. So I want to thank my friends at Kino Lorber, who are distributing the film, and for always taking such great creative choices and risks. And thanks to those friends at Film Forum for screening this film. And thanks to Kirsten Tan. So that'll be coming up in a moment. Then we're going to have on, I'm doing this sort of in order of theatrical release, since Popeye's already in theaters. They're up first. Then we have a returning Sierra Pettengill, a friend of the podcast. She was last on episode number 174 with her co-director Jamila Wigno with their film Town Hall. Sierra is back again, this time with a new film about relatively contemporary politics called The Reagan Show. It's a complete archive film. We'll get into that in a little bit. She will be joined by Pacho Velez, who is her current co-director on the new film. So we'll be having them up after Kirsten. Oh, and I should mention that film will be opening up June 30th in New York and Los Angeles. And then the last up will be Lara Stahlman, who is the director of a fabulous new documentary called Swim Team, which is about a group of New Jersey teenagers who are on a swim team, specifically consisting of people on the autism spectrum. And it is a fascinating documentary, and I'm very glad to bring on the filmmaker Lara Stahlman, who I have been running into on the film festival circuit recently, and so finally glad to bring her on to talk about Swim Team, which opens up in New York on the 7th of July. Music on this episode is by Kristen Diable, off her new album. It's called Create Your Own Mythology, now available. Ran into her performing at the recent Northside Festival in Williamsburg, and I just thought she was terrific. What a great talent. The new album, again, is called Create Your Own Mythology. Her name, again, is Kristen Diable, and you can go to kristendiable.com for more details about her album and where she might be performing soon. I wish her much luck. Let's get into this episode of the podcast. Again, this is Kristen Tan with her film, Popeye.
ช่วยซื้ออาหารป้อนมันปะล่ะ
ไม่จะซื้อมัน
รู้จักมันด้วยเหรอ
ป๊อปอายไงนี่ป๊อปอาย
มันเกินแล้วนะฉันไม่อยู่เป็นคนดูแลสวนสัตว์ที่คุณหรอกนะ
ว่าแต่ทำไมคุณกับช้างถึงมาเดินแถวนี้กันได้ครับ
คุณมีอะไรออกจากบ้าน
ก็ได้ว่าคุณเดือดช้าง
จะตาย
ช้างคุณจริงเอาเอกสารไปดู
2ชั่วโมงนี่มันเดินทางด้วยรถยนต์ไปด้วยช้างได้ไง
You live here right now
or
are you living
here? I've been based here for past 9 years, but the last 2 years I've been in and out of New York because of the film.
Right.
Yeah, so now I don't really know where I'm based. I'm just based.
Do you have an apartment?
Yes,
okay.
In Brooklyn.
So you're still a curse. The independent film Hollywood is Brooklyn. I was on the way here, and I ran into, on the subway from Brooklyn, of course, I'm sitting there, and there's this filmmaker sitting right across from me that I know and that has been on my podcast as well, named Andrew Dasumnu, who did a film a couple of years ago called Mother of George, and he has a new film opening shortly called Where is Kira, I think it's called. So it's just like you can't go anywhere in Brooklyn without running into a
filmmaker
like yourself, yeah. I was told, though, that you were going to be joined, you were not alone, you were going to be joined by Bong.
Oh yeah, he got stopped at the immigration.
Oh no, yeah, I'm sorry to hear. Well,
he didn't apply for his visa, so.
And there's a lot of anti-immigrant feeling going on in this country, unfortunately. So maybe.
Yeah, he's still stuck at customs. So okay. I mean, maybe after this interview, I'll go back and see what I can do.
And let me know if I can pull any strings for you because he won over my heart. He's a great. What a great pachyderm. Cool. He's got much personality.
Yes, it's his first.
Feature.
This is his debut film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, he's very natural.
He's great. Yeah, he's
we're talking about an elephant named Pong, who is the star, one of the stars of the film. You know, we could talk about directing an elephant in a film, but I guess the caretaker, like any animal, right, was probably right there on set.
Yes, there were five of them actually. There was a main elephant handler.
Uh-huh.
His name is Ik. So Ik and Bong grew up together.
Oh, okay.
And they literally knew each other at birth. They're almost like brothers, actually. And Bong only listens to Ik.
Ik. Okay. Well, we're talking about this film that you made. I'm going to call it a comedy just because it's our job is to reduce everything to very digestible morsels. You understand? So people can understand.
Yeah, people have been calling it a dramedy.
It is a dramedy. There's definitely drama in it. You know, it's sort of a man at a point of crisis in his life. And he... you can interrupt me at any moment. But basically, he's at a point in his life where he's an architect and a husband, and but he's kind of reached a certain, restlessness of the spirit, I guess you could say.
Midlife crisis.
Well, yeah.
Existential crisis. Yeah, I think it's more existential.
That's exactly the word I was looking for. Thank you. Yeah. And so he has this desire to go and find this childhood friend. And return him to his hometown, where he and his family had a circus.
Right. Where they kind of grew up together in the farm.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay, it was a farm. And what's your poison? What's that?
It's just iced tea.
Iced tea, good choice. And, it's a road movie. This is a road movie, and most road movies we see, somebody with Seth Rogen or somebody like that in a car, but this is different. This is this. What's the actor who plays
His name is Tane.
Tane?
Yeah, Tane. So it's very close to Tana.
Oh, Tana is the character.
Yeah, Tana is the name of the character, and the name of the actor is Tane.
Tane.
Yeah, I mean, all these Thai names, I know it gets a little...
No, I love it. It's great. It's wonderful. And it's nice to see you've brought this, I think, something Americans can really relate to because we love those kinds of existential crisis movies right here. We have a whole genre of them,
Yeah.
So this is perfect for American audiences.
And
go see this movie.
Perfect for world audience as well because I feel like with existential crisis, you get to really explore existence and the meaning of life. And I think personally that's the thing that draws me to filmmaking, like trying to figure out why we are here, trying to figure out what we're doing, and what, I guess, life means to each and every one of us.
Yeah. But we, as an American, first of all, we're talking to mostly Americans, not entirely. Thank you, by the way, if you're not in America for listening, because I really appreciate it. So I don't mean to exclude you, but the majority of people listening are Americans, so I kind of trying to appeal to their senses in a way. But you're right. And there are universal themes here, and there's a very Thai elephant here in this movie. And this is your first feature that you've directed. You've done a bunch of shorts. You've done a great job. I mean, really, and then, of course, it's going to be at Film Forum, and they're very, very picky programmers, you know. Karen Cooper is just put anything up on the screen there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, to me, it's a huge, huge honor to be able to play at Film Forum. It's almost like a dream come true.
Yeah.
I used to study at NYU, and I would come here often to watch films, and it's almost inconceivable for me, like a Singaporean filmmaker, to come all the way to New York and then to have my debut film play here. It's just
dream
unbelievable.
Yeah. And I'm sure being on Film Wax Radio, my podcast, is something also you can never ever.
Of course.
Well, anyway, getting back to my compliment, it is a very, very strong film, and the character Tana is a very interesting actor. Is Tani a well-known actor in Thailand, by the way?
He used to be super well-known, but as a rock star.
Okay.
So he was very famous.
Oh, he's a musician.
Yeah, in the 70s, and he used to bring, he brought progressive rock into Thailand. But
at the height of his fame,
suddenly he dropped out, and
why?
He just disappeared from the scene, and kind of like no one knows why. And when I asked him, he's kind of evasive about the question. Maybe he doesn't know the reason himself. Maybe it just got all too much for him. So then I was looking for someone to play.
Yeah, an existential crisis.
I was looking for someone to play him, and to play Tana, and I couldn't find like the right guy until someone in the film scene suggested Tanit to me. And for me, when I saw Tanit, he was so different from the pictures of him in the 70s. Like when you see him
hair,
now,
exactly. And he had a lot of facial hair.
Yeah, he looks kind of like a Thai Mick Jagger.
Yeah,
like really out there with a cigarette and all his music videos, very very edgy and very wild.
Yeah.
But when you see him now, he's just like this nice, polite, restrained old guy, and and like just like the difference and the juxtaposition between how he was and how he is really interesting to me. And it just feels to me like he's someone who'd understand life, who would know like the ups and downs and the heights and glories of life versus something very ordinary. So then I feel like he would be able to play the role well just because he seems to understand so much.
Yeah, he brings a lot of depth to the performance.
Yes.
And had he had any roles
once,
like this?
A long time ago at the height of his fame. So he was probably like in his 20s. And I think he did one Thai TV series and then he disappeared forever.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
so he has a bit of mystique around him too because of his disappearance.
Yeah, so this is almost a bit like his comeback.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must feel good. What does he think of the...
Yeah, he likes it very much because he carries, I guess, so much of it, and so much of the film is him too. So I feel like he's very proud of it, and he seems happy with it when I talk to him.
Did he appear with you at any festivals or?
Yeah, at the Singapore premiere, he was there with me, and we're actually having the Thai premiere right now, almost at the same time as the opening at Film Forum.
Uh-huh.
So at Film Forum is June 28th, and in Thai it's June 29th. So he's going to be fronting the Thai
premiere. How are you going to handle it? Are you going to be here?
I'm going to be here. Yeah.
Oh, you are.
Yeah.
Are you going to make it there in time?
I don't think I'll make it there in time because after the New York release, I'll have to fly to Taipei Film Festival.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That's too bad, but we're glad you're going to be at the Film Forum, right? Is it on a Wednesday? Is that a Wednesday the 28th?
Yes, it's Wednesday.
They premiere on Wednesdays here.
Yeah.
It's unusual.
I think maybe they're just trying to...
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
Take advantage of a day. Not compete with all the... Big movies that open on Fridays. Yeah. Again, the name of the movie, I don't know if we even said the name of it, but it's called Popeye. Now let's get to that, because that was confusing. It's spelled P-O-P, second word, A-Y-E. So is that a Thai expression or something? Because there is a lot of references to, of course, Popeye, the American cartoon character.
Yep. So Popeye comes from Popeye, and it's exactly a pun on that name. And I think it's only because in Thai language, it's instead of being pronounced Popeye, they pronounced it as Popeye.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then so I thought it looks interesting as well to have it spelled in something that doesn't make sense. But at the same time, I like the kind of off-kilter vibe to those two words.
Yeah, and you would have gotten sued if you called it Popeye.
Precisely.
So you couldn't do that. So it's the name of the elephant is called Popeye. Again, the character of Tana, he's got a strong, going through this strong nostalgic period in his, where he's thinking a lot about his childhood, and he wants to bring the elephant back to his uncle's home, the home where he grew up. There are a number of things that don't quite turn out the way
he expects,
and then that, you know, but at the same time, the ultimate joke is on us, because nothing turns out to be as exactly as we as it's expected, you know, as he learns at the end of the movie. So I'm going to leave that as a cliffhanger for the audience. We can't tell you everything that takes place in this film because it would ruin it. But I will say that, again, Bong is such a, this character, the Popeye, is such a wonderful, you will fall in love with this elephant. He has such a quiet, you know, graceful beauty to him, and you really do feel like he's performing on some level.
Yeah.
Through a non-performance. Yeah.
I think to me it was just important to capture him truthfully without me trying to inject like too much human characteristics into him.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's almost so tempting to make him really cute, to make him really lovable.
Yes.
But for me, in some ways, I was just trying to avoid that and just trying to, I guess, shoot him and capture him in a way that was really truthful to him. And I feel like because of that, then a very natural, innate kind of beauty of the elephant would just naturally come through.
Yeah, you succeeded really wonderfully. But you really see this intelligence at the same time. You were there on the set. Obviously, you got to know the elephant really well.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, they're supposed to be very intelligent. And
did
you really get that sense?
Smart.
That do you get a sense? Because we do, in the movie, you get a sense that Popeye really understands what Tana is going through and what his needs are. And he really tries to compensate. Not only just that there's one moment where somebody, you know, where he needs water and then, you know,
Right.
The elephant sprays, you know, there's two occasions, actually, because there's this accident also, right? But so you get the sense that the elephant really does understand.
Yeah,
do you think there's any of that that exists, or are you using a little bit
on
of
set it was really license? Clear to me that an elephant is pretty intelligent. I would say almost in between, like, human and dogs. I feel like they actually understand more than dogs. I mean, personally, I'm a dog lover. I used to have, like, 3 or 4 dogs at home, so I know them pretty well. And, and the really interesting thing to me working on this film is seeing that each elephant has very distinctive personalities.
Okay.
And once you know them, you can, their being and who they each are as individuals starts to feel very, very clear. And that became clear to me while I was casting and looking for someone to play Popeye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the reason I ended up with Bong was that I was very moved by his, somehow his personality. He felt like a really kind and generous and almost slightly mischievous elephant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I like the vitality he brings into the role.
Was there anything that in his personality that you didn't bring into the movie, though, like that we don't know that exists? Because we do get a sense of intelligence, of tenderness.
Yes, yes.
I'm not saying he can't get riled up if something spooks him, because that's the nature of, you know, just any animal, but...
Yeah, I think that the really cool thing, and maybe the obvious thing working with an animals, is realizing that they are never acting. They are always just in this constant state of being.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't think there was much I could push in terms of inserting other characteristics into his being. He was just
or
being
out of
himself.
It, or take away anything. Maybe there is more to him outside of the role. Maybe that we don't like.
Yeah.
Maybe he's...
I guess the only slight change between the real Bong and the Popeye in the film is that... Bong only makes one sound. He likes to make this really high-pitched...
That's in the film.
This,
Yeah.
And that's the only sound he makes.
That's unusual.
Yeah, it's really unusual. So
is that unusual for an elephant? Is that...
Yeah, I think it's pretty unusual, because when I meet other elephants, they make other sounds, too.
It's usually... Yeah, oh, okay.
Yeah, so then in post, and when we're doing sound design, we had to give him, other...
Is it in the
voice.
Trailer?
Yeah.
Because maybe I'll play a little of the trailer, even though it's a foreign language.
Yeah.
It's this whale-like in a little bit, but, you know, it might remind you of a whale song a little, because there's, it's a kind of high-pitched. It reminds me, there's a story about, there's this one whale, apparently that his frequency of his cries are so different. They're at a different... Do you know about this story?
Oh, yes. Like, he's the only whale in the world who can...
Yes.
Yeah, he's unable to communicate with other whales.
Yes.
Oh, yeah,
so he's the lonely whale. It's the lonely whale story. But so kind of reminded me of that. But speaking of another comparison, of just because of the timing of the film, is opening up right around the time of Okja as well, about a large...
A super pig.
Smart... loving companion type of animal to an Asian character.
Yeah,
it's just kind of.
I would love to.
It's very good. I saw it.
You saw it?
Yeah.
Oh, lucky you.
I'm a big fan of Bong.
Yeah.
The elephant, but also Bong Joon-ho, who is the director of Okja. So it's a series of coincidences. There's a lot of coincidences, and the pig is also supposed to be highly intelligent animal. And the pigs that are genetically mutated in the Okja in the Bong Joon-ho film is more outwardly like an elephant in a sense of that the size of it, as well as his the character of the animal, as opposed to like a normal pig squealing and playing in the mud.
Yeah.
They don't really care about humans too much, you know.
Right.
But so if you liked Okja, if you see it, then go see also. You're gonna love Popeye, which is the film we've been talking about. And
I remember when I first met Bong, the first thing that struck me, of course, was his size, and I guess like just standing beside him, the way he sounds, and all of a sudden in that instant, I totally understand why through the history of men, you know, like elephants, especially in Asia, is used almost or is almost always associated with royalty, with majesty. They're almost like an animal that's always associated with the gods.
Yes.
And standing beside him, I totally understood why. It's just his presence.
I can't imagine it because I see him.
It's so cool. Like his presence, and just the way he sounds, it's really deep and
It's different when you're in, because you see the, you know, in the zoos or circuses, both of which I can't wait till they're things of the past. I mean, I think we are seeing at the end of circuses here in the country.
Yes.
I mean, I certainly hope so. And then as far as zoos go, I think it's a little trickier. If they're true preservational spots, then I'm a little bit more sort of sensitive to it.
Right.
But you know, for performative purposes, we've reached the end of that period, I hope.
Yeah, and you kind of don't really see animals in their true state, in their true essence, in their true character.
Anyway. Exactly. So isn't that what we want?
Really make sense.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. But we also do want to interact with them, because then kids do grow up into being environmentalists, because they learn to meet the elephant, and they really, it's different than seeing it on a TV or in an exceptional movie like yours. See how I did that? it's really great talking to you. Does anybody interview you and not ask you as much about the elephant, because it seems to me like you can't?
This is a very casual and nice interview.
Oh, okay.
Everyone is kind of different.
Yeah, I know. And you'll come back on, because I have to run in a minute, but I would love to do another one, maybe your next film. Kirsten Tan is the filmmaker, New Yorker, Brooklynite.
It's very nice to meet you.
And the name of the movie is Popeye, and it's going to be at Film Forum on June 28th, at least for a week. If a lot of people go, they'll hold it over. There's a movie that's just ending today that's called, I forget now, it's with Cate Blanchett, Manifesto, which has been here for like 5 weeks because audiences come out and supported the movie. So you love Cate Blanchett, you're going to love Bong. That's my... And Tani.
Tana in the film and Tani.
Tani
the actor.
And the actor. Yeah. Well, it's good to have him back, you know. Mm. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's really nice talking to you.
Take me where the water goes. I need you now. I need you most. Take me where the water goes to play. Dance with me until the dawn. Can't keep the sun from rising up. So take me to the water where we'll stay. Ooh. Where you're going, I can't follow you.
Okay, segment number two again with the filmmakers Sierra Pettengill and Pacho Velez, regarding their new film. It's called The Reagan Show. It is completely told through archival material regarding the period of time, I guess, in Reagan's presidential career, where the final days of the Cold War, I guess you could say. So it's during the specific period where Gorbachev is leading Russia and the Soviet Union is falling apart. And it's a really fascinating film. And it's also, I should say, even more so about the branding and marketing of that which is the entity of the president, which we can all relate to at this point in life. I don't know if it'll help give some context to what the current chaos that we're dealing with, this craziness. This is a fabulous documentary. I'm a big fan of Sierra and Pacho at this point with this film. So let's get right into it. The film will be premiering this Friday, June 30th at the Metrograph Cinema in New York City. It's a great theater, by the way. Go check it out. Metrograph. Google that if you want to, but it's going to be there for a good week. And then it'll also be playing at the Lemley Playhouse 7 in Pasadena, California, starting on the 7th as well. So people on both coasts will have the opportunity to see it. Okay, here we go. My conversation with Sierra Pettengill and Pacho Velez regarding their new documentary, The Reagan Show.
Okay, recording.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace.
That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu.
Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the...
Okay, how are you doing, Sierra? Welcome back to the podcast.
It's good to speak on the podcast just by nodding at you, right?
Yes, you're very visual. Yeah, what was it? So how long has it been since Town Hall? Because you were on with Jamila Wingo.
4 years.
Uh-huh. Is that 4 years ago already?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah,
I haven't been doing the podcast that long.
The Obama administration.
Well, all right, but that was a year ago. It does. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, yeah, it's we look at Reagan in the context of this time we're in now, almost nostalgically. Well, certainly nostalgically, but almost romantically in a sense of, like, maybe it was even better with Reagan, you know. I'm sure you get that a lot. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny experience we had while making the film is that we were making it for over 3 years. And, you know, the election and inauguration happened at the very end of the filmmaking process.
So you're still in production? Or the post-production, which
the whole film's post-production.
It's all post-production. So,
yeah, it's all one blurry
archive.
Yeah.
Which is your area of expertise, one of your areas of expertise. Right?
Thank you. But as we... You know, we spent all this time looking, you know, with a critical eye towards the Reagan administration. And then as sort of Trump started to look more and more likely, the Reagan presidency started.
Wait a minute, what are you saying? Trump is one?
Is this just stand-up? You can just do stand-up.
Well, maybe we'll see by the end of this.
Oh, God.
I haven't been able to do an impression in years of Reagan,
Jesus.
So you've given me the opportunity.
Well, yes. Nancy and I were...
So the second half of my sentence.
I know, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm excited.
I know. It's hard not to be excited about Ronald Reagan. So, but as Trump was taking up more and more of the news and then eventually became president, the Reagan administration started to look rosier and rosier, which was something that was not what we were anticipating as we were making the project.
It's like levels of Dante's Inferno or something, maybe. It's just another level down, you know. Hopefully we're at the 7th level because I can't imagine getting worse than this.
Hotter, yeah.
So we're talking to Sierra Pettengill, as most people listening now know, or have probably figured out. And silently sitting next to her, at her immediate left, is Pacho Velez.
Hello.
It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
And thank you for coming and doing the podcast. Together you've co-directed The Reagan Show, which is premiering Friday, the 30th of June, at the
Metrograph.
Metrograph. How fantastic.
Yeah, that's down, right. Down on the Lower East Side.
That's right. It's just by Canal Street.
The Lemley, Pasadena
in
L.A.
Okay, great. Well done, Susan Norgut. That's all I can say in terms of helping. And then who's distributing the film now? Gravitas?
Gravitas.
Gravitas. Yeah. Okay. As I mentioned earlier, just a few minutes ago, Sarah, you have also a background in archive. You've done worked on other films with that hat, right? So did that... I mean, the question is how much
did the project
that,
start?
Yeah.
So Pacho actually found...
Sit down, Pacho. You're not going anywhere.
Pacho actually found this Reagan archive, which is at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library.
Okay.
Which was an archive of footage shot by the Navy under this department called the White House Television Office, which documented everything Reagan did over 8 years. And he and Dan Garber, who's our... amazing editor, one of our amazing editors, started looking at that footage with an eye towards looking at Reagan through performance and acting. Sorry to answer for you, Patra.
Oh, yeah, no, Patra.
No, it's fine. I kind of am curious to hear your telling of it. So.
Accurate so far? Yeah, and then I... and then I came on a bit after that. But yes, it's all archival. We looked at 1,000 hours of footage between our team. And
how long does that take? Just kidding.
3.5 years.
okay, you told me years. I'm just saying, look at 1,000 hours. How long does that take? It was a joke, but more of my stand-up routine.
They're very good jokes.
No, I know. I appreciate your humoring me, though. All right, so how did you guys... is this how you met then? Is that how you met, like through...
We met at an Art of the Real screening.
Okay. Up at Lincoln Center.
Up at Lincoln Center.
Dennis Lim.
Yeah. We were at a table afterwards chit-chatting. I think I invited Sierra to come be a guest artist at my class at Bard College.
Oh,
I
was teaching at Bard?
Okay. Yeah, I was there that semester. Oh, great.
So we can move on.
Sierra and I started talking, and it... Sarah has a very deep interest in presidential biography.
I know. It's terrific.
Yeah.
I do too. It's how I perfected I can do impressions of all the presidents pretty much.
We just do that.
Can you do any?
No, but either of you?
No, but I was going to ask for your Coolidge impersonation.
Well, since nobody can challenge me on it, I've actually been doing Coolidge. So thank you for picking up on that. Well, The Reagan Show is archive. It focuses primarily, I would say, on the years where Gorbachev was in Russia running the country and the final years of the Soviet Union. So you could say it was maybe at the cusp of the Cold War, the end of the Cold War, correct? Which is a really, really fascinating period of time. One wants to know, well, what did that look like? And especially now there's been, 30 years.
And it's also a moment that I think... is both obviously a key historical moment, but also a moment that sort of is maybe not as examined as certain other moments during the Reagan presidency. You know, obviously people who love Reagan love to talk about the assassination attempt. Mm-hmm. They love to talk about the 1984 election. People who really immensely dislike Reagan talk about his response to AIDS. They talk about the air traffic controllers strike. They talk about Iran-Contra. And so this is a sort of a moment that in some ways
overshadowed.
Falls between the cracks sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Even though it changed the world and the whole geopolitics of the world, right?
Yeah.
The
years of I think this is part, part of what helps cement Reagan's legacy is his sort of success in this realm. And one of the things that was interesting to Pacho and I was taking a look at... more broadly, like how narratives get established. And so that's something the film's doing. So we wanted to look at that idea of this being something that helped cement his legacy. This is, a large success and how, look at the tools that made it happen. So looking at how that legacy was able to be formed. And, as the film shows, that's largely through PR and images and the way that the Reagan administration was creating media to help tell their story. So, the film is about kind of the storytelling of the end of the Cold War.
Before branding was called branding in a way, his presidency was branded. When they started kind of figuring out how to do that and how to affect people's impressions and the people's opinion and therefore controlling people and outcomes of elections and other things like that.
Right, and here we are.
Here we are today. Yeah, there would be no Trump without Reagan, I think. Definitely it starts there.
Yeah, and I mean, there's obviously, there's a number of sort of moments that you can point to as the start of the sort of entertainmentalization or spectacalization of politics. You can you can also point to the Kennedy-Nixon debates in 60. You can point to the selling of the president and Richard Nixon and his work with Roger Ailes in 68. But clearly the Reagan administration was, and their sort of their openness to public relations, and in fact in many ways their sort of privileging of public relations over the actual business of governing, or rather treating public relations as though it were synonymous with governance, definitely was a way station on the path to where we are today, and I mean, kind of unfortunately, probably where we're headed in the future.
Just getting back to when you're saying how you give a lot of context to this lesser known period, maybe overshadowed period, because of the maybe the same reasons of like how things are just so packaged and marketed. That whole period has been reduced to one line in our collective memory, which is Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall, which is a very, you know, emotional, provocative. It's a great moment, undeniably. But now we have, because of the Reagan show, we have a much broader context of what was going on during that period. This fantastic archive stuff that you guys have unearthed. And Josh Alexander is a buddy of mine. He's hanging out with us at DCTV2. I know Josh for many years, and I know he started off as an actor and as a kind of a fiction filmmaker, and now he's sort of evolved into this documentary
writer.
Writer. Yeah. So how did that, you know, like, did you guys reach, how'd you know about him? And
I worked with him on another project.
Which one was that?
Prescription Thugs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
I mean, Pacha was also a writer on the film, and one of our editors, Francisco Bello, you know, a film like this is all, as we were saying, post-production, and so the writing element is a pretty heavy one. You know, we went through so many different kind of iterations, and you know, when you don't have any outside voices, be it interviews or, you know, narration, or there are very few interventions in the film. It's all archival telling the story. That kind of writing actually feels maybe counterintuitively it's more important. And so Josh came in at the end, and
it's organizational to some degree, right? Is that what you're saying? It kind of organizes the material in such a way to make it's a story.
Right. And it's, you know, it's making sure that you have enough context at any given moment to allow the scenes to be readable. And in this film, you know, we wanted the viewer to be looking for and looking at performance and acting and seeing each scene through that lens. And in order to do that, you have to kind of set them up well enough so that by the time you get to kind of the meat of the Gorbachev story and the negotiations, you're able to look for those things in those scenes. And so that, I think that's a lot of what we were trying to do, is get there. But I don't.
Pacho, was it anywhere in your purview and in your mind frame to try to also take, I don't know if your impression of Ronald Reagan as a president, as a person, as a terrible actor, I don't know, but if it at some point it had evolved in some way, and if you were trying to also incorporate this into your film and the perception of him, I don't know, or maybe during the making of the film, your impression altered in some way. I'm just curious to know.
Yeah, I mean, it's a film that's sort of as much about the archive and the image that Reagan projects, and sort of the circulation between that image and the ways that the media abets that image making while also critiquing it. And so there's a way that was sort of the, I think in many ways, sort of the focus or getting at that sort of way that there's a kind of image that Reagan's projecting, and then the media is like picking up on that image and sort of critiquing it, but also using it for their own ends and using it for their own sort of media spectacle, which then gets recycled into Reagan watching TV, which is part of the film, of course, too.
Yeah.
And then gets regurgitated in this other form. And so there's a sort of circulation or cycling between Reagan and the media that both is about a kind of critique, but also about a kind of way that the two sides need each other, a kind of codependency. That's developing over the 80s. And so even while a lot of the explicit language is a language of critique, hopefully the film also captures the ways in which there's a kind of circulation of Reagan's image between these two different media spheres. And that's something that I think was really important to capture in the edit. And in that way, it's much more about the public face of Reagan and how Reagan was understood in the 80s to the American public than it is a film about the private Reagan.
I understand.
It's not the,
we're not going, yeah, we don't go there.
Yeah, you don't really go into the residence too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things that we talked about a lot was that, you know, there's Reagan, the interiority, the concept of interiority with Reagan is like a kind of infamously impossible thing to crack. All of his biographers have expressed a, you know,
frustration,
incredible frustration. Yeah, there's a limit to how close you can get. His Nancy said, you know, you get so close and then something happens. There's, you know, there's a real limit to understanding him from a sort of typical biopic psychological perspective. And so we thought the way, you know, someone who's been in front of the camera for, you know, all of their adult life, one of the best ways to actually image him, to understand him, is to look at the images that he's creating and producing. And so that was our
I just wondered,
way of reading.
I understand, but I was wondering, because you said something like, how many hours did you say?
I think it was close to 1,000 between the TV news and the...
Okay, because it's... I just wondered, because he is so enigmatic... And he seems, to the degree where he seems enigmatic to himself as well, like he doesn't really have a sense of, I don't get the impression that he has a sense of who he really is, even though he's the dad, he's the father of the country.
And you read his books and you listen to his interviews, and he doesn't go in for introspection in a big way.
Yeah. But he was this Hollywood actor at the height of golden years of Hollywood, and he played cowboys, and he played occasionally like a gangster, I suppose, or something like that. But
I think he was in 57 films, and only one of them did he play a bad guy. His very last one.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
that's the one.
He smacks around Angie Dickinson.
Well,
yeah, he gets punched by Cassavetes. It's Don Siegel's The Killer, 1964.
Oh wow, what a great little intersection of the old and new, huh? Isn't it? Because he's like on his way out. As John Cassavetes is,
yeah, it's a good clip. Angel.
Yeah, I got to go back and see that. And I like the connection to Don Siegel too, since they just remade another one of his movies.
Sure, The Beguiled.
Yeah, The Beguiled. Go ahead.
This is all the way of saying, I think Sofia Coppola for president, 2020, maybe.
I don't know. I don't. That sounds just as good as anyone to me at this point.
Yes, let's try a woman. See how that goes.
Seemed as though we clinched it there for a second or two. I mean, what do we make of that? I mean, you know, we can talk about, in a way, this artificiality about polls that mean nothing. What is all that about? None of the polls meant anything. So aren't we still lost in this kind of artificial political sphere all these years later? I mean, isn't it just all still
branding? Yeah, I mean, I think Trump is kind of the like metastasized version of, kind of an inevitable rotting of the system. But, you know, like I said, we didn't know this was coming. And we thought of this project as being a way of looking at the roots of the present tense.
Okay.
And, you know, you can trace all presidents after him. You know, as Peter Jennings says at the very end of our film, spoiler alert, you know, I shudder to think what presidents are going to have to do after Ronald Reagan on television, in the realm of television, and I think that's...
But do we think... I feel like if Obama, on the other hand, really had a great sense of who he was, you know, maybe I'm just not that... Maybe I'm not just not that smart, but I just don't have a sense. Don't have to go there. But I just didn't get a sense that this was somebody who was manipulating or being manipulated as much or to that degree. Hopeful thinking?
Well, I mean, I think of it as more than a kind of left or right thing, or more than a sort of way of talking about it in terms of any sort of particular person. It's much more about a kind of like systemic or sort of epical change that we're seeing. And Adam Curtis talks about it a lot. And it's
Adam Curtis,
the documentarian Adam Curtis.
Yeah.
British guy? Right? British guy, yeah.
I interviewed him, so I don't really know him that well.
And I mean, his films, there's a lot to dislike in those films, and there's a lot of ways that he's way too bombastic in other ways, but he has a sort of a very sort of succinct way of talking about how in the 70s politics went from being an activity of the nuanced description of a complicated reality to being about presenting simplified narratives. And he really talks about Thatcher and Reagan as being the sort of the birth of this, the sense of politics as a space for the feel-good, simple narrative, us and them, good and evil, and that kind of simplified language has sort of found its way into politicians on all sides of the aisle, to varying degrees. And so that's what we're seeing right now, I think. And it's, and Reagan is sort of
he's very good at it. Yeah. I mean, I think it's
whether he knew it or not, I think he just naturally gravitated into that role so well, and being like that guy, because I just think that was his comfort zone.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also important that this is the Reagan administration also is coinciding with, you know, advances in media technology and the rise of CNN and kind of the beginning. It's the very beginning of the 24-hour news network, and so the sort of ability to have your image, you know, present and communicated all the time is a new opportunity.
Yeah. And obviously, love him or hate him.
Increased role of television news.
Love him or hate him, Ailes. Well, we hate him, but Ailes, you know, definitely was visionary in that regard. He saw that before just about anybody, right? So.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he could harness it for good, that knowledge.
You can trace this entire, from Nixon on forward, just through rail, so.
Amazing, right? There's another documentary for you. And he'll be in it. He'll figure it out somehow or other. I'm sure he'll be in it.
Holograms.
So you were at, where, go ahead.
One reason that we were able to make this film is because in the U.S., once someone's passed away, they're not protected by libel laws.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about being sued.
Yeah.
I redact that.
Oh? No. So tell me, you were at some event where, was it a screening, you said? And then Chris Matthews came? Or is that
you're one? Eavesdropping on a...
Eavesdropping? You were talking about it out loud in front of me. I don't know if that's it.
I'm having coffee now, so I'll be less snarky in like 3 minutes.
You can be snarky. First of all, I come to expect a certain amount of snark. I don't say that critically. I know this woman for a couple of years, at least four now, at least maybe more.
Yeah.
I enjoy her snark.
My reputation.
Yeah, good snark, lady.
It's okay. I don't have a good story about that. Yeah, okay. I didn't see him or interact.
Oh, he just showed. But it's good to know.
Yeah.
I was wondering I mean, it's still a little early, although you've been through a bunch of festivals, obviously. Where did it premiere again?
Tribeca
Film Festival. I guess that's how I saw it. So that's it?
Tribeca, AFI Docs in D.C., Nantucket.
That's going on now, right?
Seattle, SF Docs in San Francisco.
So good bunch.
Oh, Montclair.
Oh, right, yeah. All great festivals. And have any politicians had a chance to see it? I don't know if anybody in the, or media, big media.
We're just kicking off.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Checking on Friday.
Not that this has to be included, but is there a broadcast or anything like that set up? Or
it'll be on CNN in September.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Okay, but we're not talking about that because right now we want to get you to go to the Metrograph Theater, which is a wonderful theater. I suppose this isn't going to be projected on film, but they do have that capacity. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Yeah, no, this whole film is made out of... standard def.
That would have been odd to go from video to
beta,
two.
Yeah. Right? It's the only film almost entirely on video where we talked all the way through about down-resing. Anytime we got sort of an HD photo, we'd have to go through a long process of mucking it up to look as bad as possible.
Interesting. Okay, so it's going to be at the Metrograph. Go to the Metrograph Theater because it's a fantastic theater. If you haven't gone yet, go June 30th. The weekend of June 30th is a great time to go. us New Yorkers that are stuck in New York here this weekend are going to go to the Metrograph Theater. Let's all get together and head on down to the Metrograph and see the Reagan Show. And I believe you're going to get Reagan there. I think he's going to come.
Also a hologram, yeah.
And if you're in the Los Angeles area, it's going to be at the Lemley Pasadena Theater, I'm told. Is the same day?
Yeah. And okay. Josh Alexander, the writer, aforementioned writer.
He's going to do the Q&A there?
Yeah.
Josh Alexander, who has been on this podcast. I'll have that information for people. So if they want to meet him, through, because he came on around the time of prescription thugs.
Magazines.
Just have a There is a movie about that. No, what's the one? What's her name? She just did it with the girl, and they go. They these teens,
oh,
a
American
bunch of
Honey.
American Honey. Thank you very much. So I don't. I have to prepare psychologically, but they go around and they're subscription thugs. Wouldn't you say? It's a group of marauding.
It's a group of marauding. Wonderful trailer.
Post-millennial marauders who go around trying to thrust subscriptions on, you know, unknowing into people in the suburbs. Again, the Reagan Show. It's wonderful for anybody who's like this subject matter we've been talking about. If you're into it, this is going to be like candy for you. So just check it out. And thank you very much, guys, for
thank you
for coming on and
thank you
putting up with my Michigas and my impressions. But
can we hear Reagan one more time?
He will. Mr. Gorbachev, Mr. Gorbachev, please. Oh, no, he wouldn't say please. Tear down that wall. Yes.
Your facial expressions are remarkable. I think.
Again, for the benefit of my listeners. Well, I don't know what it is. It's one of those that he just, I get him. I get his whole.
What about H.W. Bush?
I would be doing more like an impression of, like, probably like closer like a Dana Carvey kind of thing. You know, which, so I don't. He's just, it's so ubiquitous, that impression, that you can't just, I have to go back and do my work.
Okay.
I'll work on it.
Okay.
And my Donald Rumsfeld, much, much underappreciated for his ability to be impersonated. Susan, you have something you want to say? All right, guys. Anyway, I'll let you go.
Thank
you very much. I appreciate it. Piercing, number 3, Lara Stallman, filmmaker of the documentary called Swim Team. I've already mentioned that it's about a group of autistic teenagers who comprise a swim team in New Jersey, and this is their story. It's a very, very engaging and entertaining film, I should mention. It is not a downer. It's being distributed by my friend Jim Brown's company, Argo Pictures, and it will be in New York at the IC Center. Beginning the 7th of July, and then it will be premiering in California at the Lemley Monica Theater in the 13th of July and other select cities. You can Google Swim Team and can get all the details of that as well. It's also, she's at the film's on Facebook and Twitter, etc. So this is my conversation with the lovely filmmaker Lara Stallman.
Guys, give the best as you got. Who's
all
with me?
Right.
Hammerheads!
Hammerheads!
Some kids, they stare at me, who's this fast kid?
The front show may be a little bit tough, but the breast show may be really hard.
As I know, autistic means some person that's different than other kids.
Our team, they have some type of autism spectrum disorder, which is not very common for a swim team.
goes,
coaching a special needs team versus a regular swim team, it's night and day.
Lara Stoneman, we met at a party for Doc NYC. It was like a little party in advance, right, of Doc NYC, where your film, which we're going to get to in a second, where it had its New York premiere, New York City premiere, New York premiere. And then we met again at Montclair, which was one of your hometown, if you want to call it that, home state screenings. The name of the film now is called Swim Team, which is a wonderful documentary.
Thank you.
It's won a bunch of awards, I see. Like, it goes to a festival and just usually wins some big award there, typically. People really respond to it.
We've been really lucky.
Is it luck when you put years into a project?
Oh, you know, thank you. It's you hope that it's going to be well received. And, you know, but you never know, because so much is subjective, right, about film. And
well, yeah, it's true. But usually a well-made film gets enough people to respond in such a way where there's a commercial benefit to it. You know, enough people will see it and talk about it in a positive way. The reviews are good. So there's that. That's a phenomenon that occurs, too, to films that are well-made. Okay, so I'm just saying, you know, not to have a Swim Team in particular. It just happens to be an example. But any film. So you just came from POV before you came here.
Yes, yes.
And so that's a big piece of news right there.
Yes, we'll be broadcast on POV in the fall. So I'm really thrilled about that.
Just vaguely now in the fall? We don't have a date.
No, actually, I do have a date, October 2nd.
Oh, wow. Okay, people, take a moment. We're going to give you a moment. Dead airspace, just to put in your calendar, October 2nd, for the broadcast premiere of Swim Team. And we haven't even talked about what it's about. All we know is and as I mentioned with many other filmmakers over the years that have been on this podcast that have had the benefit of having their film play on POV or their sister show on public broadcasting, you know, it really means such a larger audience. So it's really,
yes,
a small film, it's a great, great opportunity.
It is. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so thrilled is, you know, now many people will have the opportunity to experience the story.
Mm-hmm. And the story, let's get to that, because I've been putting that off. It is, in fact, about a swim team, which is based in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, correct?
Right.
And it consists of not your typical swimmers.
No. Each swimmer on the team is on the autism spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the kids actually have additional diagnoses, but they are all on the autism spectrum. So it's an unusual swim team.
Mm. In my lifetime, I've seen a couple of things occur, and it's a pendulum phenomenon. One is that we used to discard anyone with any kind of problems like autism, if in fact one wants to describe it as a problem. But people with autism, if they were indeed even diagnosed as such, they were treated in such a way where they weren't even an opportunity to enter mainstream activities like joining a swim team. Then it seemed as though, once we realized there is this diagnosis, there was a swing the other way where we were maybe treating people too preciously, where, you know, it was, interrupt any time, by the way, because it was like, you can't let these people swim, they'll drown.
Well,
and now we're finding something in the middle here.
It wasn't that long ago that people on the autism spectrum were shipped off to institutions.
Right.
You know, for many people, the point of reference is still Rain Man. And that, in fact, was about a character living in an institution. And that was the norm for people, not just with autism, but with developmental disabilities for a long time. And it really, it wasn't that long ago that was the norm. And still, so many people are with developmental disabilities and specifically autism are excluded from all aspects of our community life, starting with public school. They're excluded from, you know, a gen ed classroom. And for most of the kids on the team, actually, you know, they hadn't been in a general education classroom as children, as young children, and they hadn't been exposed to community sports.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the kids on the team hadn't been on a community sports team until this team.
I guess I was thinking that being overly precious with people that are on the spectrum, that we're to some degree doing them a disservice. We should put them in the mainstream school system, find a place for people with, on the spectrum in schools and on swim teams and in other areas of life, because they may do exceptionally well. It may be so much of a benefit to them. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. Not just to try to protect them to such a degree.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, definitely what this film is about. We have characters that kind of run the gamut in terms of the severity of their disability and or disabilities, because one of our main characters has not just autism but Tourette's, and you know, his disabilities are very disruptive to his family,
yeah.
His family life, his experience in the world, and. You know, I think this film is very much about the fact that, you know, even individuals, you know, that need a tremendous amount of support still mm-hmm. have things to contribute to our communities. And, you know, they shouldn't be excluded.
Yeah. And how are we ever going to treat people different from ourselves less differently if we don't interact and experience these people like anyone else? That's my thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I prefer it that way. You know, I don't need everybody to be exactly the same. And by the way, you said this one child, what's his name? The one that has both autism and Tourette's.
Kelvin.
Degrees Kelvin, right? I mean, you're not a doctor. You're
nope.
a filmmaker, correct?
I'm not a doctor.
Do you
doctor.
Have a medical degree? Okay.
Much to my parents' chagrin, I am not a doctor.
Oh, well. But are these two things connected in any way? Are they connected?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I haven't been asked that question. I did do a little bit of research, though, because, mm-hmm. You know, I was wondering myself, and we don't know. There's no.
Okay.
No
I mean, evidence. Why not? Right. Some people, there's, you know, maybe people with Tourette's is a real small number. Right. I mean, generally speaking, I'm sure a very small part. I'm not asking you for statistics at all.
I didn't do that research.
Not even
sorry.
No, I'm not asking. I'm just saying, even anecdote. We know that there's a very small percentage of people have Tourette's.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, whether it's 1% or smaller, whatever. I don't know. But the point is that it's very possible that you could be with something else, have some other sort of pathology or some other kind of experience, and then you also happen to get a second. It's just a roll of dice, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's not necessarily have to be connected. I just thought maybe there was Kelvin's instance.
Well, interestingly, it was the autism that was apparent, that presented itself first. You know, when I was asking his parents the story of how, you know, they first discovered his disabilities. For years, they just thought it was autism. And then it wasn't until he was, I think, 12 or 13 that the Tourette's started to emerge.
Tease them apart, these two things that were going on with him. Well, what we did mention before, because I kept yammering on about it, was mainstreaming these children is great for not only them, but also, I think, for everyone else. But that in this swim team, they're treated like the expectations are pretty high. There's a lot of pressure on these kids. They're not being,
coddled.
They're not being coddled at all. They're expected to deliver, to be on time, to practice, to compete at their fullest degree.
And to win. They're expected to win.
And to win. Wow.
That's one of the reasons why I was so intrigued by Coach Mike, the coach of the team, and the team before it was even a team, because I met him before the team came together and he told me about his plans for the team. And he had, you know, he said, I think early on that he wanted the team to dominate the competition. Mm-hmm. And I was just so struck by that because people don't usually talk that way about special needs kids. And I thought that was, you know, fascinating and mm-hmm. you know, could make for an interesting story. You know, what mm-hmm. happens when kids who, you know, most people have very low expectations for, you know, what happens when they have high expectations, you know, that are when people have high expectations for them, what happens?
Well, in order to get the answer, see swim team, because it will surprise you. Yeah, you focus on three of the teenagers essentially, right? It's the Kelvin and
Robbie and Mikey, and mm-hmm. they're on a relay team, and I thought that it was really, you know, made a lot of sense to focus on them because they were on the relay team and they had to work mm-hmm. together. And people with autism generally have a lot of challenge with socializing, social skills, and swimming is an individual sport. But if mm-hmm. you're swimming on a relay team, you know, on your swim team, then you do have to interact with one another. And so it was very intriguing to explore that. And some of my favorite scenes in the movie are actually when the kids are interacting with one another, that verite footage of them, you know, talking amongst themselves and, you know, figuring out how to deal with each other. And it's not always smooth, you know. Sometimes Kelvin, he has verbal tics. He's the character with autism and Tourette's. He has verbal tics and he has body tics. And of his verbal tics, he swears all the time. And, you know, he likes to say the F word. And it drives one other kid on the team bananas. And every time, you know, Kelvin says the F word, you know, the other kid says, "You said the F word." And it's shocking at first and it's funny. And, you know, Kelvin has, you know, these great responses like, "I curse a lot," and yeah. "Sorry."
He's tall kid, right? He's Kelvin, isn't he? A little bit tall. It seems like he's.
If he's the tallest.
Yeah. But doesn't the other child understand intellectually that these are things that are out of Kelvin's control?
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, the other one is on the spectrum as well.
Yeah, and so. he knows he is. So he knows where all the kids are.
Yeah, I wonder. You know, it's interesting to see, though, how that relationship develops through the film and how, you know, there's a scene at the end of the film where Kelvin gets, you know, really, really worked up and upset. And, you know, there's a moment of tension because you don't know what he's going to do. He's unpredictable. And it's this other team member who helps to calm him down and says, you know, mm-hmm. gives him, you know, the strategies that he knows Kelvin can use, like count to 10, take a deep breath. That's one of my favorite moments, actually.
Mm-hmm. That was going to make the final cut. Speaking of which, do you have to now do a broadcast cut, or did you already have one?
So I do. I'm in the middle of that right now, actually. I'm cutting it down.
That must be really hard on you.
It is because this, you know, we have this film is a sports story and
it, you know, really relies on building attention and pacing
We left the races, you know, pretty intact, like they're almost to time, like they were in real life. And
the actual races,
the swimming races,
you know, a lot of the big portions in the film.
Yes. And I think that's one of the reasons why the film is so satisfying. Mm-hmm. You know, we've certainly found screening it so far at film festivals and with community screenings that people who are into sports, you know, really think that it rings true and they find it to be exciting. So, you know, I think that's important. It's hard. It's really hard to cut stuff, you know. It's really hard. But
yeah, what's the theatrical length?
So the theatrical length is 100 minutes. Uh-huh. And that's what, you know, we'll be showing at IFC Center when we open on July 7th.
July 7th, folks, just in case we'd left that out. Right, July 7th for the theatrical at the IFC Center, which is terrific. Was that a result of something at DocMyC? Or is that just...
No.
Okay. I know that that's, if you know, you win certain awards, you get a guaranteed week at the IFC Center.
No.
But that's neither here nor there. Mm-mm. You got it on your own merit. That's great. And it couldn't hurt to have been in DocMyC. You know, I'm sure John Banco and his folks knew about that and, you know.
That would be great. You know, yeah.
So the kids, they must have shown up at some of those festivals or screenings early on.
Oh, yeah. They were at DocNYC. They were all up on stage.
Oh, they were. I missed it. Yeah.
And in fact, it's on YouTube because DocNYC filmed that Q&A.
Right.
So if anybody wants to see it, they can go on YouTube and, you know, search DocNYC swim team Q&A.
Yeah, they have a channel.
But it was wonderful to have them there. And it's they come with me to screenings per their availability. And it's and, you know, it's never easy to get a group of people together for screenings because everyone's so busy. But they love the film. The kids love the film. The families love the film. Mm-hmm. And And I'm really happy about that, actually.
Well, I'm sure it's got to feel great to have such support at this stage, especially while you're gearing up for theatrical and broadcast and all that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because it's, like you say, it's almost arbitrary. Any film, you know, you never know what's going to, the path it's going to take. But it seems like this has had a very gratifying path for you as a filmmaker.
So far, so good. Yes. You know, we've done a lot of, we've played a lot of festivals and, you know, we've been, you know, we've won a bunch of awards, which, you know, it's really great. And we're doing a lot of community screenings. Mm-hmm. And
yeah. Well, it lends itself, doesn't it?
So, you know, that's really exciting. And I am excited about the theatrical release. I think one thing we've learned, and, you know, the experience of doing film festivals, you know, is invaluable. You get lots of information about, you know, what's working in your film and who's responding to your film. And it's been, you know, really important. And I realized that this is actually a film that plays well theatrically. Mm-hmm. And that's not always the case with a documentary. But, you know, what's great about the theatrical experience is that people can hang out after and talk. And we have incredible conversations after our screenings. And, you know, really, it's an opportunity for people to share their own experiences about their own kids on the spectrum, you know, their own problems that they've been having with finding inclusive activities and finding pathways for their own kids going through the transition years. And it's important to be having these conversations because, you know, we do mm-hmm. have a public policy, you know, issue, I think, in our country with how we you know, support individuals with autism and developmental disabilities.
Having said all that, we should also emphasize this is not a polemical film. It's really not. It's about you know, competition and community and families, and there are certainly things you can take away, and there are definitely, I would think, the film rather lends itself to you know, institutional and educational types of screenings and distribution. But at the same time, I wouldn't say that this is a advocacy typically in the same typical way advocacy film. It's not like you have a call to action per se.
Not per se.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, yeah, I understand. So go and just expect to, you know, have a good time is the point.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, certainly that those were my instincts, that I wanted people to, you know, to experience the journey, you know, that this team and these families were on, like, you know, during the course of the season. And it's, you know, it's sometimes there are times where, you know, you might cry and there are times when you might laugh. And I think there's times of tension and
waiting for somebody to show up at a competition and they're,
oh, don't give it away.
Oh, that's right. Will they make it or won't they? You have to see the film.
And there are times when I love that people actually cheer and clap during the film. Uh-huh. And that's really great.
That's always a good thing, you know, unless you're like the producers in the movie, the producers, in which case you don't want, you don't want the applause.
No,
yes, of course. I'm assuming that it's and it, as you said, the Q&As are very, very, the conversations are really, you know, terrific afterwards. So again, Lara Stallman is the director. The name of the film is Swim Team. It's going to be opening in New York, at least. It's got to have a New Jersey theatrical.
So we're going to be in New York for a week at the IFC Center.
On July 7th.
Starting July 7th. Mm-hmm. And then we are definitely going to be in Los Angeles at mm-hmm. the Lemley Monica. Mm-hmm. And we are moving throughout the country from there. Okay. We're adding screenings like, you know, by the day. So check our website, swimteamthefilm.com.
Swimteamthefilm.com. And you're on Twitter?
Yes, and Swim Team the Film on Twitter.
Okay, and Facebook.
Facebook, Swim Team the Film.
So subscribe and follow, like, and everything else so you can keep in touch about this film. I'm sure I'm reaching some people who this might affect more than others in a very personal way. So I think it's always great. There's so many different ways into this issue of autism now through film and documentary. You know, what was Roger Ross Williams' film?
Life Animated.
Life Animated. That was a pretty big success. That only helps, I think, other films on the subject. So, you know, I think there's...
I think so.
You know, it's important.
Yeah.
It was a big hit.
Yeah, I actually haven't seen it, so...
Yeah.
Sorry.
You were busy. Your hands were full.
Comment,
you're
yes.
making a movie. But he did the podcast. It was nice.
Now, when you're making a movie, you don't, it's hard to watch other movies.
I think it's good not to see it while you're making the film, too. It shouldn't impose itself on your process.
Well, actually, I did think about that, and I didn't watch...
I don't think the two are very, very different in many different respects, but...
I actually didn't, you know, I made a point not to see it because I didn't want to be influenced in any way.
Right.
But I was familiar with the story, and I thought that, you know, there's room for stories.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, because that character has autism, you know, doesn't mean that, you know, there isn't room for a story like Swim Team with characters who have autism.
Sure.
I actually think that Swim Team isn't just about autism.
No.
It's about lots of other stuff too.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was trying to say earlier, in terms of community and competition and
family,
as I think I used that term. I may have. But yeah, you're right.
And in fact, you know, we've gotten support from people along the way who are not connected to autism, but they're connected to other things in the film. Like, for example, I have a producer who felt very hooked personally by the film because she's a parent. She's not a parent of kids with autism,
right?
But because she's a parent, she felt, you know, very connected to the story.
Yeah, these are just children. Everybody has the same feelings about their children, regardless.
And we've gotten some funding from, among others, the Aetna Foundation, and the Aetna Foundation supports films and enterprises and organizations that emphasize the importance of healthy living, especially in underserved communities. So that was their way into the film.
These are the insurance people?
Yeah.
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 Well, thank you so much, Lara. I'm glad we were able to meet up finally and get this done. This was fun.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. You bet. We're going to put this up in time for the theatrical, though, even though you have all the great things on the horizon. I think this is where you can use the boost the most, right? The theatrical. So I think, and then I'll just put it out there again in time for your broadcast later on. You know, we'll just remind people, but this will premiere like days before your IFC theatrical, your Lemley Monica theatrical.
That would be great.
Nice meeting you, or seeing you, I should say, Lara. And thank you, by the way, to the listening booth, the people at the listening booth where we recorded this today. Isn't this great?
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and thank you for subscribing, for telling all your friends. Thank you for going on iTunes and leaving a review and a star rating. You know how to do that. You go to iTunes and you search Film Wax, and it comes up, and then you select Film Wax, and then you, if you're not already subscribed, you click on the subscribe button, and then you can also click on the rate and review this podcast button, and go have at it. Please do that, though, if you haven't done it, because I need to... be discovered more on iTunes. It's the biggest way people listen to podcasts by far. I forget the numbers, but I'm sure 80% at least of all podcast listeners are experiencing the podcast off of iTunes. So we really need to make the show discoverable. How do you do that? Well, you just do what I say. You subscribe and you leave a rating and a review. And besides, I'd like to know what you're thinking, even if it's not always the most positive thing. You can also find us, of course, on Facebook if you go there under Facebook.com/FilmWaxRadio. And you can also find us on Twitter, Instagram.
YouTube. But yeah, that's about it, I guess, right now. I know I've been promising more on Spotify and on SoundCloud and others, and I will accomplish that as soon as I can. It will happen. It's in the works. So that's it. Okay, guys, I'm going to duck out of here. We'll be back in a few days with a brand new episode of the podcast. We've got a lot of great guests coming up. I'm booking some really wonderful guests, by the way. But if you have a suggestion, as always, please do feel free to contact me by going to filmwaxradio.com, and you'll see a link right there on the homepage where you can email me, all right? And I do get everything, and if I don't respond immediately, that does not mean that I won't respond. I try to get to everybody, and if I don't, if you feel like I've ignored you, possibly I missed your email, possibly it went into a spam folder, so feel free to follow up. I promise you, I am not ignoring you. I get back to everybody so far, because I don't get that many emails. I can certainly get back to you. So if you're listening to this and you've emailed me and I've not responded to you, first of all, I'm sorry. But secondly, just email me again or re-email me, whatever you want to do. I promise I will get back. But you can also use other forms of social media to nudge me, and I will get back to you. Does that mean I can help everybody? Does that mean I can see every film? Does that mean I can, I don't know, bring everybody on the podcast? No, it doesn't mean that. But it does mean you deserve some attention. By the way, I should mention, if you're still listening, if you are expecting me to watch your film, whether it's a short or a feature or otherwise, please just send me the link to the whole thing or tell me where I can go see it. I generally can't get to the theater, but if you're at a local festival not too far from New York, I can try to come to that. If you are doing a special screening in New York, the New York area, I can try to come to that. So feel free to invite me, and I try to get to what I can. And then as far as just viewing it on my computer, of course, that's optimal. And I do get to see almost everything people send me that in that way, okay? It doesn't mean that I'm going to love everything I see, but of course, you know that. And it doesn't mean that even if I don't, that I won't give you feedback or whatever it is you're asking for. I just need to know. And people send me the trailer as maybe a way to engage me. But the truth is, if you just send me the link to the film and the trailer in one email, that's easiest, okay? I do see almost everything that people send me. Thank you very much, by the way, for just even thinking of doing that. It's an honor, and that's why I do try to see and everything people send me, and I do try to respond to everybody, because it's an honor, it's a privilege to be on your mind or in your thoughts as somebody who, you know, you think should see it. So thanks for that. All right, guys, I'm going to let you go. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. We're presented by Rooftop Films. And until next time, take care of yourself and the ones you love. If your heart it changes, your desires rearrange you, I'll stand tall beside you, like I said. Cause